War Room, Impeachment. With Stephen K. Bannon, Jason Miller, and Raheem Kassam. Here's your host, Stephen K. Bannon.
Welcome to War Room Impeachment, Episode 6, 26 October, Year of Our Lord 2019. We started this last Monday. This is your go-to place for everything about the impeachment of Donald J. Trump, the 45th President of the United States. 1 hour a day on the John Fredericks Radio Network. We want to thank John Fredericks for allowing us to have this hour. 7 days a week, all the way through the acquittal of Donald J. Trump, which will probably happen on the current timeline sometime right before Christmas. We will be here through the acquittal and for the day after to wrap up this and summarize this historical process. We're here to bring you detail of the testimony, the witnesses, the process, the legal aspects, everything that's happening. I'm joined by Raheem Kassam, who is Nigel Farage's right-hand man and kind of ran the whole situation for the European parliamentary elections, for the United Kingdom Independence Party, UKIP, and also for Brexit, managing editor Breitbart London, and Jason Miller, one of the top communication strategists in the conservative movement and the communications director for Trump 2016, which we won because of Jason Miller, and also in the transition. Okay, gentlemen, we got so much to go through. First off, Jason, big week. Summer, why don't you tell us what happened this week?
Huge week. Number of developments we saw, Steve, where I think this is the week that it really turned around. Number of developments. First of all, a lot of the president's allies got off the sidelines and really started fighting back. We launched this radio show and podcast. We saw Republican AGs make their voices heard, which was great. If you look around, again, this isn't something that maybe folks in the Beltway or even in some of the areas where we're broadcasting at the moment realize. Republican AGs have been, attorneys general, have been all over the place this week. This is fantastic. We saw our House allies, Matt Gaetz, Andy Biggs, Jim Jordan, Mark Meadows, Lee Zeldin, who, by the way, Zeldin's an absolute superstar. Yep. We saw them go and take the fight to Shifty Adam Schiff in a massive way, calling out this sham process that they have going on. We've seen all these things start moving in the right direction. And maybe the most important thing is it appears to be that the White House has got it. And there have been reporting over the last 24 hours that they possibly might be bringing in former Treasury spokesman Tony Saig to be part of a pushback effort. This is something that I endorse, think is fantastic.
100%. Tony ran the entire communication strategy for the tax bill. He's a total pro.
Absolutely. This is if you're a Trump supporter out there listening, you don't know who Tony is, you need to know who Tony is, because if he is appointed to this position, it's going to be a massive help. And again, the folks at the White House, they have Stephanie Grisham is doing a fantastic job at comms director. She needs more help. She's doing three jobs. She can't do four jobs. That's not realistic. So this is the week where we saw Trump allies step up, start fighting back, start driving messages that work, and we're seeing it. And Steve, you want to
in Wisconsin already? There's a poll. This is CNN doing an analysis of the polling and talking about the national polling trending towards an impeachment support for an impeachment inquiry. And even support for removal from office. But when you look at it broken down by state, and particularly some of the key battleground states, Wisconsin, it looks like only 41% of the people support it. So this is now, and this is even before messaging getting out. The entire purpose of the War Room is just to get up information that's accurate information. We're going to go through who the witnesses are. We're going to go through what the testimony is.
And one additional thing, can't believe I missed this from the list. Possibly the biggest thing from the week that was absolutely critical, that Lindsey Graham went and pushed this resolution to condemn the House activities. Now
that was the flesh out. That was the flesh out. What?
That was to go and essentially say, where are folks? Where are Senate Republicans? As far as their willingness to say that this is a sham process and to criticize it. Because we saw, for example, the Daily Caller story from Henry Rogers last week that said that only seven Senate Republicans would say under no terms will they stand behind Trump in impeachment. So what this did is this went and fleshed out which Senate Republicans are solid or which are wobbly. And so initially, here's why pressure matters. And this is what everyone listening needs to take away. When Lindsey Graham first put that out, he had 44 cosigners. And then magically, because of the pressure, within 24 hours, then you had Rob
44 cosigners meant you had 9 Republicans that were not going to sign. That
9 means, sitting. Which
that means you're 11 away from an actual guilty verdict in the Senate.
And that is super dangerous. And then magically, within 24 hours, Rob Portman, who Steve, as you yesterday described, as the heart of the Senate, he came on board, and Dan Sullivan from Alaska. And then
– who's in a reelect.
Right. And then you had 4 other folks, because of the pressure, jump on board. So right now, only 3 Republican senators.
The wall of shame there is Murkowski in Alaska, Collins in Maine, and good old Mitt Romney.
And that's Willard.
The conscience of the Senate. Okay, well, let's go.
But,
we got so yeah. Go ahead.
Not so fast.
Yeah,
my friend. The story that came out of the resolution, the McConnell-Graham resolution. From the Dispatch, the guys that spun this thing off from the National Review, got a leak ostensibly from Tom Cotton's office, shows that it's pretty obvious, guys, shows that the resolution had to be watered down to bring that many senators on board. This had to go from being a full-throated...
What do you mean watered down?
It had to go from being a full-throated defense of the President of the United States to say that there was no quid pro quo and that Trump had done nothing wrong to just being an attack on the process. And so it's not... I don't look at it as great a victory for Trump. It's a great victory for the solidarity.
I don't know if
senators.
We're not looking for a victory. We're looking to flush guys out. We're looking to flush out votes. Right now, we know we got 3. They need 20 to convict.
That was a great roll call.
They need 20 to convict, and they got 3. Okay, so they're 17. They're 17 short.
And two things can be true at the same time. Raheem is absolutely right.
I agree.
This is a
weak,
watered down version.
Yes.
But at the same time, we have now forced every Republican in the Senate to come out from the tall grass.
Yeah.
To let us know where they stand. If you're a Republican senator and you can't even say that this is a sham process, and again, when we say watered down, there's nothing in this resolution that's pro-President Trump. Everything is about the process. If you can't put your name to this, are you really a Republican at this point? And, I mean, Willard's off on his own planet. But look, here's what Senator Collins needs to realize. There's not going to be a 2020 reelect victory for her in any scenario if President Trump gets impeached. So this is just so – anyway, so two things are true. Raheem is exactly right that it's very, very weak language, but also forced an initial head count.
Let's go back through – I want to go back through the week first, talk about witnesses. Remember, in the war room and warroom.org, you can get the latest breaking news. It's your one-stop shop to go through on everything on impeachment is between now and essentially Christmas on this historic event, which is an impeachment of a sitting president in the trying to stopping the Democratic process. Let's go through very quickly. Just wrap up. What happened this week? Why was this an inflection point, Raheem?
Several reasons. I mean, obviously, this was the week where it appears that the White House has started to take this much more seriously. Since when we thought about putting the show on air up until probably about middle of this week, there wasn't much sign that people were taking this whole thing as seriously as they wanted to. And as the week progressed, and I'm not saying it was just this show, but there's been a lot of people listening to this show and listening to what we've been talking about and suggesting and so on and so forth. And there's been a lot of people out there as well.
And we had Meadows on his best summer. He had Matt Gaetz the day after. Matt Gaetz's event showed really strategic thinking about how you open this thing up and let people know it's a star chamber. Let people know it's a secret process. Let people know that it's not inclusive of all congressmen.
But now remember, this week was the week that the Democrats had their. This is a casting couch, right? They're rolling these witnesses through behind closed doors and seeing what sticks. And this was the week they had Taylor. This was the week they wanted the guy, William Taylor, who would go on the record and say, hey, Ambassador Sondland, United States Ambassador to the EU, Trump donor, was out giving it fast and loose. And this is what was causing parallel tracks in U.S. foreign policy that effectively went all the way up to the President of the United States, or at least the President of the United States lawyers. Now they want to call Sondland back because Taylor contradicted him in a 15-page testimony that establishes still, regardless of what he said about the parallel tracks, establishes repeatedly that there was no quid pro quo over and over and over again in Taylor's testimony. Tim Morrison told me, no quid pro quo, these guys told me no quid pro quo. Zelensky said
this
is why the
this is why the White House needs an operation. As soon as they get that opening statement, they ought to be pounding out the counter narrative like the mainstream media. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, this is sophisticated political disinformation warfare run by Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats.
And as an extension of that, it's also important because I imagine that that opening testimony. There's a good chance that maybe it's not given to the White House, or maybe it's not given to the broader Republican Party in the same way that Republicans allowed Bill Clinton to have access to all these things 20 years ago. This is also why we need to be taking a look at what we're trying to do here at War Room Impeachment that we'll get to a little bit later, looking through the backgrounds and the bios of everyone going up to testify, because the media wants to present them as next in line to be
canonized,
given sainthood.
Yeah, this is Mother Teresa, and then you got the guy from the State Department coming up here.
Right, so we have Philip Reker, career Foreign Service officer, now serving.
How unique is it for people to work in this town on Saturday? Officially, I mean, this is how they're running this blitzkrieg. It's going to be 6 days a week from now until they vote the two articles of impeachment.
And again, that's why Nancy Pelosi is the single best comms director on the planet, because she knows that at the end of the week things got a little bit muddled. We started punching back. Some of the numbers were a little bit different. House Republicans did a great job this week. Republicans are showing additional unity. She wants to make sure the Sunday shows are properly framed, the narrative is set in the right direction and influenced.
That's why we're on Saturday. We're going to be on Sunday Live, 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. on the John Fredericks Radio Network. This is War Room Impeachment, Raheem Kassam, Jason Miller. Two other events before we go to talk about witnesses and testimony. Major events. Number one, we finally got Kupperman. Kupperman last night said they're going to go to court to see if he has to testify or not. I don't know if it's an injunction put in by the White House counsel, but somebody's finally listening. You got a government employee. Now, Judge Luttig, who would have been on the Supreme Court, he's considered one of the top judges in the country. He said that if this goes all the way and is argued to the Supreme Court, may be one of the most important cases ever in the history of the country about separation of powers. Now we're getting down to it, folks. That's why this impeachment process is so important. Everything comes together. Everything's going to be unified in this, you know, understanding, you know, what is the opportunity cost the country's not doing, what the Democrats are doing this, what the separation of powers are. This has got everything. So this thing with Kupperman is going to be quite – finally somebody stepped up. I don't know if Pat Scipione gave him an injunction or whatever, but he said he's going to court to see if he should testify. So and Luttig said it'll be one of the most important cases ever in separation of powers. Also, we found out – that they're starting a criminal process. The U.S. Attorney Durham up in Connecticut that's been looking at, I essentially say Crossfire Hurricane or whatever it's called, the code name that started the process. But brothers Clapper and Brennan better lawyer up, okay, because now all the free shots on goal they've been taking on CNN and MSNBC, stand by. It's a criminal process. You know, Clapper and Brennan already leaked out that they're being looked at. So, hey, boys, time to lawyer up, because now you're in it.
And don't forget for Clapper, he's already been nailed for lying to Congress once before.
Yeah, see, this guy. Here's the beautiful thing. Those guys have been on Trump. All the legal process, the adjustment, when it was going their way under Mueller, it's all great. Now last night their heads are blown up. This is a politicized DOJ. This is a witch hunt. I mean, they're stealing some narratives. Let's go to the to the witness today, Raheem. Who do we have, and what's this? What is he going to testify to? People think this is a slow day, but that's not the case, is it?
Yeah, I don't think so. So Philip Reker, the Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, again, another one of these guys with a great career in foreign service, former ambassador to Macedonia. He served all across Europe before, significantly in Eurasia as well. Yale guy. I want to read a quote for you. He's a workhorse, not a showboat, said Daniel Fried, a former diplomat who resigned at the onset of the Trump administration. He comes from the Masha Yovanovitch school of professionalism. He's a capable, nice, relaxed guy, not at all stiff, and he's utterly nonpartisan. Now, nonpartisan in the civil service, in the career civil service, effectively means they think they're right. They think these are the people who
100%.
These are the people who
this
think
is the apparatus.
That the president,
I don't call it deep state, it's the apparatus.
That the president right. exists only to give them jobs so that they can implement policies they believe
in. This is absolutely important, and this is a narrative that we're going to be driving, because we have many, many, many people coming for us now from the apparatus with information, with leaks, with stuff we're going to be breaking the next couple weeks. And generally what they're the theme that we're getting is that if you line up these people right here, they have their own point of view, their own perspective, their own angle of attack of how these things should be handled, of how the Ukraine should be handled, how Russia should be handled, how the entire process. Hey, note to self, that's what an election is about. Donald J. Trump is commander-in-chief, okay? Mike Pompeo is the Secretary of State. There's a chain of command, and when the order comes down that this is the way we're going to roll, that's the way you're going to roll, and that's what I think we're going to see in this next couple of days is get back to Morrison's thing. The call could have been better. Well, hey, maybe it could, maybe it couldn't. That's a judgment call for you. The call couldn't have been better. Let's go back to this guy today.
Steve, this is why I said to you earlier this week that when Taylor starts his testimony, there's 15 pages, which, by the way, if you have 15 minutes, 20 minutes of your life, it
you
is
have
worth
to.
Reading. This is
warroom.org, our website. You have to go read. If you're interested in this, if you're a Trump supporter, you know, put down the channel changer, you know, get off the iPhone for a second. And get onto our website and do some reading. Get up to speed. Be more knowledgeable than your neighbor.
Put Joe Rogan on pause.
Right.
And
get
go,
serious.
Go.
If you're serious about defending Trump, and if you're a serious deplorable, the type of person that listens to the John Frederick radio show and the John Frederick radio network, do some work. I don't hear any whining, no tears. Go on the website. Look at Raheem's analysis and look at the raw testimony.
Look, in the first three pages, Taylor goes, I love Ukraine. I sat on an NGO in a board of an NGO in Ukraine. I believe this for Ukraine. I think that for Ukraine. Well, hey, you're not there to bring your beliefs to the table. You're not there. I don't want your love in a policy briefing, right? What you want is them to follow the direct chain of command. This is their job. And how is it, Steve? Explain this to me. All these people that are coming out over and over and over again. Now, these are mostly careers. These are mostly people who have found themselves on the long track. You know, they like Laura Cooper, who we saw earlier this week. These are people who study civil service, foreign service, George Washington, SAIS, all these schools that just churn out
Georgetown.
Civil servants. Georgetown, all of that. And Rika is another one of those guys, and he's going to be the one up there today. But here's where I think it gets interesting. And I don't think I've had an incorrect call this week, so I'm going to make another one.
No, you're in a roll.
Right. Maybe it stops today, but we'll see. Look, Rika is a guy who is fully subscribed to the Yovanovitch school of thought. Now,
what do you mean
the,
by that? Who's Yovanovitch? Bring in another character.
I'm doing it. Okay. Now I've got the name out. People are like, oh, who's that?
Okay.
This is how you draw people in, Steve. I've got
Theater of the mind.
Maria Yovanovitch is what the media refers to as the ousted U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. Well, I mean, ousted in the sense that the administration didn't like what she was doing.
The president of the United States got full responsibility and full authority to choose his ambassadors, right? And some of the career guys stick around and some don't. That's just a normal course of business.
Now, there are all sorts of theories that go around about Yovanovitch and what she was doing and who she was talking to and whether she was implementing Trump policy or not. And those are judgment calls for the administration to make, frankly. You know, that is the full discretion of the president.
I don't think that raises to impeachable offense.
Well, quite right. But Yovanovitch had a particular, it's the same thing, globalist career foreign service worldview. There was a plus-cachange approach to this stuff, you know, from going... You want to define that?
Yeah, but can you translate that?
this is somebody who believes that foreign policy...
It's Saturday morning and we're broadcasting to Central Virginia. You're going to have to translate
I start throwing French out. Look, this is somebody who believes that the foreign policy, no matter who is in the White House, foreign policy shouldn't and doesn't change.
100%.
It is set within these
institutions. It's the old British. It's the way the British establishment
runs. Just to cap on that and bring Jason in on this, that is where Rika is going to approach this from. Rika is going to try... Yeah. Quote me on this.
Yeah,
is going to try and point fingers at Rudy Giuliani.
And why Rudy?
Because Rudy
off
is the
books,
one.
Going
Rudy
rogue.
Is the one that they accuse of having this parallel track of foreign policy going on across Ukraine and Europe, and he's the one that they blame for attacking Marie Yovanovitch and getting her fired from.
So this is what Rudy really takes center stage today. You're saying in this testimony.
So let me jump in, Raheem. Fantastic analysis. Yeah. Some of that I didn't understand because I'm just a troglodyte Trump guy. But but excellent breakdown. But the point that you brought up there, that I think is that's so key on the foreign policy front, is this goes to what we should be doing to ask Rieker and other folks testifying to really drill down on these folks and to get these questions out there before exactly. They've. So, for example, one of the questions right off the top that I want to see asked of Rieker: do you believe in President Trump's foreign policy? And do you believe that it's your job to implement his foreign policy? So right there, we're going to see them start getting squirrely. What's okay, well, so you say most of the time. Oh, what does that mean? And then let's pivot to if they're a career person, let's put that back on them. What's your chain of command? Okay.
This is the key. Right.
I
want to see what's going up the chain of command. I want to see how many times you talked to Pompeo about this. I want to say all this stuff. This is what you're going to see at the end of the day.
Let's take their experience and put it back on them.
Yep.
And just very bluntly, how did you allow Ukraine's election interference into U.S. elections in 2016? How did you allow that to happen on your watch? That's what I want to ask a career guy who's supposedly unimpeachable himself. These are the tough questions that we need to be putting to these folks so the mainstream media can't go in and make them look like they're ready for sainthood.
Exactly. And at the end of the day, you're going to see that this is a policy dispute, inside the apparatus. You got something else to jump in here before we...
No, that's exactly right.
Why – how is the mainstream media framing our witness today?
Very down the line, as that quote I read to you earlier, they call him nonpartisan, all of this kind of stuff. They're very keen on this guy. They're very keen on the apparatus around this person as well, the Ivanoviches and the people who have been there for a long time. But you said something just now about the fact that these people on policy have a major dispute with this administration, so they think, right? Even though Pompeo comes out,
and he says, by the way, you're right, because this is why Trump got elected. The decline of American greatness is tied to America First, and America First doesn't mean America isolation. It's not America in retreat. It means America. It's in the vital national security interests of the United States. It'll be in the vital national security allies. The globalist apparatus has a very different point of view.
These are managed declinists.
That's the point. Explain to that. We got about a minute. Explain what managed decline is.
I'll give it from a British perspective, since I have that, and we had an empire. Remember, once upon a time, we had a career civil service.
We were a part of that.
Right, quite, and you will be again. Don't worry. we had a career civil service who decided that their job was to bring Britain back from the world, to give power off to everyone else, whether it was China, giving Hong Kong away and, handing over, we had our Arabists in our civil service and so on and so forth. That's what's happening here in the United States now. These guys, globalists, they want the EU to have more power, they want China to have more power,
right,
and they hate America.
We've got to bounce for a commercial break here on the John Fredericks Radio Network. This is War Room Impeachment, Stephen K. Bannon, Raheem Kassam, Jason Miller. When we come back from the break, from Baker Hostetler, one of the most impressive and important constitutional lawyers in town, David Rifkin, he's got an op-ed in today's Washington Post that's going to blow your head up. President Trump's going to want to read this. We're going to read it to you next when we return on War Room Impeachment.
War Room Impeachment. Here's your host, Stephen K. Bannon.
Welcome back to War Room Impeachment on the John Fredericks Radio Network. Stephen K. Bannon, Raheem Kassam, Jason Miller, live Saturday morning in our nation's capital, right next to the Capitol in the historic Breitbart Embassy, the center of the populist nationalist revolution in our country. If I can so modestly say. We're now joined by, I think, one of the most revered legal minds in Washington, D.C., and that's a pretty august group. This is a gentleman that has served in President Reagan's administration, President Bush 41's administration. David Rifkin is from Baker Hostetler, one of the most prominent, powerful law firms in the nation's capital in the country, and he has written, quite frankly, an extraordinary op-ed in today's Washington Post. We're trying to have the most cutting-edge people about the impeachment process. We're trying to have the – excuse me, it's in the Wall Street Journal. Even better, because it's in back of the paywall. That's what we want to have David on today. And naturally, being back of the paywall. David wrote so many brilliant pieces during the whole Mueller investigation. He's one of the great legal minds out there. We want to make sure that this gets in front of President Trump today. I'm not so sure President Trump's got the code. Since he cut off the subscriptions to the Washington Post and the New York Times throughout the government, I don't know if he cut off his Wall Street Journal, because I know the president reads the journal every day.
Something tells me he's going to find a way to go on Google and get around the paywall and yeah. still see those. Yeah. Don't have, like yeah. all of
yeah.
us do.
Yeah. I don't think he's going to stop reading Maggie Haberman's screeds. I don't think Maggie Haberman's hate mail is going to go unread in the White House. David Rifkin, thank you for joining us on War Room Impeachment. Can you summarize your op-ed in the Wall Street Journal today for those that are not on the other side of the paywall?
Of course, and thanks for the nice billing here. Two basic points. The way this alleged impeachment process is being driven by the Democrats does not constitute a proper deployment of the impeachment power. So everything that the House is doing is ultra vires. Based upon the fact that you need an authorization from the full House to constitutionally invoke this very formidable power. By the way, I don't know if your listeners realize, we argue, of course, that even if there was a House rule that authorized the Speaker to deploy impeachment power, it would be constitutionally suspect. But actually, there's no rule at all. So what Speaker Pelosi did basically is kind of entirely freestyle. There's no obvious reason why some other member, unfortunately a Republican minority leader of a House, cannot get up tomorrow and say, I'm going to commence the impeachment process directed against somebody else. But the second part, looking at, and I understand we're in the impeachment inquiry stage where facts are being developed. I'm basically arguing, we're basically arguing, my co-author and I, that what the Democrats have put on the table so far is not a high crime and misdemeanor. Do a little bit of a deep dive in the Constitution, how the framers rejected the more capacious formulation of impeachment power, was called maladministration, in favor of high crimes and misdemeanors. Still pretty capacious definition, but more cabined. And I think important to underscore, despite the typical notion that you hear a lot these days, that the framers were primarily concerned about preventing another King George from arising, it's kind of vulgarization of our constitutional history. What the framers were primarily concerned about, of course, they were concerned about abuses of executive power and judicial power and any other governmental power, but they're primarily concerned about legislative supremacy. They kind of expected that the legislature was the most powerful branch that they created. If you look at the British practice, the parliament was extremely powerful. And by the way, not to get in a long discussion of revolutionary period here, but the framers really, a founding generation, really were looking at until very late in the game to King George to save them from Parliament. So their beef, to put it simplistically, was primarily with the Parliament. So these are the two points of a little bit of elaboration.
Hi, David. This is Jason Miller. Absolutely fantastic op-ed that you wrote today. I think there's one other point that you made in the op-ed, and we were just talking about this in the previous segment, in addition to the two main points that you raised, and that's the point that this is also an effort to politically undermine President Trump's foreign policy agenda. And so Democrats and career bureaucrats, they hate President Trump's America First foreign policy agenda. And again, this is their effort to go and work around that. And I think you point that out in here. I think along with the process not being a proper deployment of impeachment proceedings, that there are no high crimes or misdemeanors, but also this is such a blatant political play to go and undercut his foreign policy efforts, I think is an important third point that you made in this op-ed and should go along with it, your first two.
Agree, and well, for me, it kind of works into itself into the second point, why it's not high crime and misdemeanor. But you make an excellent point. Let me emphasize the fact that the president, impeachment is proceeding on the basis of his utilization of his core constitutional power, and the president has plenary foreign policy authorities, is particularly dangerous for the separation of powers. Because look, if you look, for example, at the Nixon and Clinton impeachments, whatever you think about them, they were essentially accused of private wrongs, right? Cover up of Watergate break-in, in case of Clinton, you know, Levinsky and the cover up of that and lying, and perjuring himself. Again, whatever you think about it, and there were good things or bad things, These are, again, not exertions of core constitutional powers of Article II. This one is. We frankly have to go all the way back to Andrew Johnson, who was essentially thought to be impeached unsuccessfully. He was acquitted in the Senate because of his violation of a 10-year in office act, which was eventually found to be unconstitutional. So it's somewhat similar, but, I mean, we're talking about an enormous number of years in between the two, where there the impeachment was sought based upon the president's exercise of his sort of core domestic organizational, how you structure your cabinet, because he fired a cabinet member in violation of his congressional statute. But here is the president, and by the way, I'm not even getting to the merits of America First foreign policy, because to me, as a constitutional lawyer, it's not about the merits. I happen to think that Trump's foreign policy is good. But if I thought otherwise,
exactly.
It still would not
the point is, the point is, it's not about the merits of it. He won the election. He's the commander in chief. It is the foreign policy. This is what we're. This is a theme we're going to develop. David, let me ask you. This editorial in the Wall Street Journal today by you and your co-author is so different than what I'm hearing on CNN and MSNBC all day long. They got Lawrence, what tribe? They got the entire raft of these constitutional lawyers from GW, from all these places.
Pre-Barrara.
A famous U.S. attorney ran the Southern District of New York. One after the other, just a barrage of guys that totally differ from you. How could you be so different in your analysis and your assessment? And why are the voices like you coming to this, a month into this fight?
Well, I wish I'd written it earlier, but sadly, unfortunately, tragically, I cannot find enough strong adjectives. People at this point in time, including a number of people I respect as good colleagues and peers, are slicing it entirely as a partisan issue. The level of anti-Trump animosity, bordering on derangement, is so high that it warps people's judgments. I, frankly, was not a big fan of Clinton, but I did not support Clinton's impeachment, and I wrote at the time expressing my concerns about it. I mean, not to pat myself on the back, I really call it as I see it. When it comes to a constitution. And that seems to be exceedingly rare these days. But I wish there were more people who would be writing about it. It is a time of tremendous peril. And I feel very bad about the president. It's utterly unfair to him. But let me dramatize for your listeners. It's even worse for the constitution because that's all we really got. That is the unifying texture, unifying fabric. That's what keeps this country together. Warts and all, and the constitution,
David,
is being destroyed.
Okay, I want to go into that. Fried's car had a very good 1 hour called On the Brink last night, and it was about the constitutional crisis that is before us. Why do you say that we're heading into a constitutional crisis? And you use the word peril. It's the reason we're doing this show. This show and what we're trying to do is so important for the simple reason that we said we are now in uncharted waters. And this country and the Constitution is going to be in peril. David Rifkin, why do you say that?
Very simply, it cannot be allowed. This impeachment process cannot be allowed to succeed. Look, let's be pragmatic here. The House is going to impeach the president. That's akin to an indictment. It's going to go to the Senate.
As sure as the turning of the earth, Nancy Pelosi is going to indict him on two counts, right? Abuse of power and obstruction of justice?
She's going to throw that in there, and abuse of office, abuse of power, violation of constitutional oath, all those nice nebulous expressions that really do not signify anything other than the fact that he's carrying out his constitutional responsibilities. But let me very briefly elaborate. So he's going to go to the Senate. In my opinion, anything less than a staunch repudiation by the Senate of this without reaching the merits. And look, I'm not a politician. Maybe it would be good for the president politically if the merits were reached. But in my view, the Senate should dismiss this summarily in a way that shows what they think about the House process. It's just a quick legalistic point. The Senate's jurisdiction to conduct an impeachment trial stems entirely from the House properly employing its impeachment power. The House has not properly employed its impeachment power. The Senate has no jurisdiction, and the Senate is supposed to sit as a court. The first task of any court, okay, is to assess its jurisdiction. My fear is it's not going to happen. I'm pretty sure that the president would be acquitted in the Senate.
I want to get definitional, though. When you say staunch repudiation and immediate rejection, to you, a victory for the Constitution, our republic and the American people, would be for the Senate to do what?
To basically not hold the impeachment trial, to have a abbreviated discussion. Again, look, I'm not a Senate parliamentarian. I don't care how abbreviated. But in essence, the Senate, whom the framers conceived of a major check on the House because they expected them to come, while getting in the 17th Amendment discussion, who selected senators versus who selected members of the House of Representatives. I would like for the Senate to repudiate the process, say the House has not properly deployed the impeachment power, therefore we have no jurisdiction to consider the merits, full stop. Courts in this country do it all the time. If you come to a court in a situation they have no jurisdiction, they will throw you out, whoever is the moving party, and not reach the merits. My fear is that the Senate may not do that. The president would still be acquitted, but it would set a terrible precedent. Terrible precedent, not only for this presidency, but beyond.
David Rifkin from Baker Hostetler, one of the most revered constitutional lawyers in this city, someone who served under President Reagan, President Bush, but did not think that the impeachment of William Jefferson Clinton was appropriate, has got an explosive op-ed on the pages of today's Wall Street Journal behind the paywall. David, we're going to come back to you. We're going to make you the official legal consultant to War Room impeachment, because your wisdom and your knowledge is unparalleled.
My pleasure. Thank you, gentlemen.
David Rifkin from Baker Hostetler. Okay, I want to go to you first. Jason, that right there is the line of attack. Right?
Yes.
You can see now the major driving. This is what people have to start thinking about. We need our constitutional lawyers. We need a constitutional debate here, not just on the merits of what the foreign policy is, but he's taking it up a notch.
This is the legal argument that Trump allies have needed. Right here, we put this in front of every Republican AG around the country, every former Republican U.S. attorney. We put this in front of every member of the House, every member of the Senate. We put this in front of the mainstream media. This is the legal argument that we've been desperately waiting for. And even better, what we have from him, we have our elevator pitch. That's very simply. We talk about this is not a proper process or deployment of impeachment proceedings. There are no high crimes or misdemeanors. And this is all an effort to undercut President Trump's foreign policy views and his agenda. That's our elevator pitch.
Exactly.
That is.
You can have difference of opinion about America First. You can have differences of opinion about the direction of American foreign policy and national security policy. Legitimately have those. And that's why I say you don't need to demonize. You can have it. But that's not what this is about. This is about trying to take the power of that away from the office of the president. The office of the president. And that's why this is going to be – we are going into a – you know, from Fareed Zakaria last night and David Rifkin, The Wall Street Journal, we are hurtling into a constitutional crisis. And we're being forced there by a group of radicals in the House of Representatives that have been triggered by this anti-Trump hatred. The hatred of the individual have made them now irrational, and they're going to put the country in jeopardy. Forget the opportunity cost of not focusing on getting new NAFTA, USMCA passed, of focusing on the legislation about China, of Hong Kong, of prescription drugs, whether it's domestic or international or about our economy. The opportunity cost here is high. The country is going to be driven into a crisis by a set of radicals on sophisticated political warfare run by Nancy Pelosi, this political disinformation campaign, and now it's all been exposed by David Rifkin.
This is what David is saying. This is not just an attack on President Trump. This is utilizing President Trump as a cudgel by which to attack the Constitution. Don't forget, in the early 2000s, there was a conference at Yale, sponsored by the Open Society Foundation, and it was about, quote, rehabilitating the Constitution for 2020, and they thought they had it locked down in 2016, where this woman was going to come in and allow them to do all the damage they wanted to the office of the President of the United States and start farming things out to the career bureaucrats, right? It didn't happen. America stopped it in 2016, so this is their way of getting to it. But here's the thing, Jason, you said this was the legal argument. This, honestly, I'm a hard guy to impress. This is not just the legal argument. This is the historical argument. This is a constitutional argument. This is an emotional argument.
I've known David Rifkin for a while, and I got to tell you, during the Mueller investigation, some of his pieces in the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal were absolutely brilliant. This is a man with gravitas. This is a man with knowledge. This is a man that also can separate himself from the moment. He just said he did not support that. You know, he's not a partisan. He did not support the Clinton impeachment. Thought it was the process was for a private wrong. Right. This is someone that goes all the way back to the Reagan administration. This is the type of heavy hitter we've needed to step up here.
And
somebody had to make a play. That's what I kept saying. Somebody's got to step up and make a play. David Rifkin just made a play.
The Wall Street Journal is behind a paywall, so we're going to pre-see this over at warroom.org so that people can catch up in bullet point form. But I want
to. And by the way, we're going to link back to the Wall Street Journal and make sure you guys get plenty of traffic and plenty of subscribers.
But it's the last line in this that really does it for me. Alexis de Tocqueville, 1835. A decline in public morals in the United States will probably be marked by the abuse of power of impeachment as a means of crushing political adversaries or ejecting them from office.
Give us that again. De Tocqueville. De Tocqueville. Democracy in America.
1835. A decline of public morals in the United States will probably be marked by the abuse of the power of impeachment as a means of crushing political adversaries or ejecting them from office. Boom. Bingo.
This week was the inflection point of this, wasn't it? Finally, the Trump forces woke up, whether it's Matt Gaetz and this brilliant move in the House to expose the fact that there's a secret star chamber that's down there, not the Judiciary Committee, but behind closed doors. Mark Meadows coming on here and saying that, hey, I don't even get to look at the transcripts unless I go back into the skiff with a Democratic staffer looking over my shoulder, and I can only take down notes. And by the way, we're going to do a minority report. To David Rifkin now coming out and making this central constitutional argument that we now can take this up and fight on high ground, right? That we do have the high ground here.
And Steve, you said this just a few minutes ago, but this is really the first time in this entire month of back and forth and getting into these proceedings and these testimonies and all the political nonsense from the deranged Democrats on Capitol Hill, this op-ed from David Rifkin, who, by the way, you can follow him on Twitter at David Rivkin, R-I-V-K-I-N, reading this, this is the first time that I've genuinely felt that we have the pathway forward.
Exactly.
That we have we have both the elevator pitch, as Raheem described it, the legal, historical, and political deep dive. This is it. This is our roadmap.
This is it. And this is, look, it's now time to fight back. It's now time. I actually think that if we get all the information out to the American people, and he sets a foregone conclusion like I did that Nancy Pelosi for political purposes is going to do it, but you can make that vote so hard. Up until this last week, it wasn't a hard vote. That's why the key was the eight. You know, we're talking about 18 Republicans that are retiring that could vote for it. We're talking about Kinzinger and the guys that just don't like Trump that could vote for it. All 31, you know, the in Virginia 7, which is the John Frederick Radio Network, right into the heart of it. Max Rose. In Staten Island, New Jersey 11, all of those districts, easy vote. This is what will make it a hard vote because it's not about Donald Trump. You're going to be voting against the office of the presidency. You're going to be voting against what the revolutionary generation, right, and the framers laid out. I love the fact he went back to Parliament and said it was about legislative abuse.
You know, that's the first American I've ever heard who agrees with me that the thing wasn't about King George. I've said this for so long now. This was Parliament over and over and over again. Parliament had more power than the monarch. This is how you know Rifkin's a serious guy, in my estimation. If you can bifurcate that and understand the revolution through that lens, I trust
this is the purpose of the show. What we're trying to do is lay it all out: the legal arguments, the who the witnesses are, what is the content of the testimony, right? What is the process? What's the media war that's going on? What is Nancy Pelosi's next move? What is the President Trump and the White House next move? And today we had from the Wall Street Journal, and today's behind the paywall, This impeachment subverts the Constitution, by David B. Rifkin Jr. and Elizabeth Price Foley. I want to thank David Rifkin from Baker Hostetler to be on here. We're gonna now make him the unofficial legal expert to have
can
him.
Can we afford his hours? That's a high price firm.
Exactly.
Well, that's why we only had him on for one block. We can't afford the whole hour.
Where do you think this goes over the weekend?
Look, not just over the weekend, but you've got Rika going in at 11 a.m. today. Okay, that'll be an interesting testimony. It'd be really interesting to see what leaks out of that. And by the way, what did we start this show on? I said that Rudy's going to be in the spotlight. By halfway through the show, Rudy was the top three stories on the CNN.com website, right? Not related to Rika, of course, but you see how this all sort of plays. They know they've got a leak. They know they've got something that he might say or somebody might say he said. And so they're now...
You know, the criminal prosecution of... The criminal investigation on Clapper and Brennan, not that high. But Rudy... Rudy making the phone call to the NBC reporter. Somebody's got to take Rudy's cell phone away from him.
Look, that was in my guess, a strategic play to own the libs, to go
make them
once again focus.
That was the dead cat. That was the dead butt on the table.
Keep going.
Focus on the fact that Mayor Giuliani has a successful security consulting business and put the focus back on that. So if you can't see that, then the TDS Democrats are owning you.
Hang on. This is why Jason Miller's the best. No. You don't think the Trump campaign every morning wasn't tough? This is why Jason – he's unflappable.
When I'm in trouble, Jason, I'm calling you. That's all I'm saying. When I butt dial somebody, you're going to be my second call.
Okay, you listen to War Room Impeachment. You've got Raheem Kassam from Nigel Farage Group and Brexit. You got Jason Miller from the 16 campaign and the transition. Stephen K. Bannon, the food and beverage director. And on the John Fredericks Radio Network, you can go to warroom.org. We're here 7 days a week from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. live in the nation's capital. Focus on the most important, I think, event in modern political history, at least the 21st century, the impeachment of Donald J. Trump, the 45th president of the United States. For War Room Impeachment, we will see you tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. live.
The switch on some 2 million residents this weekend due to the threat of wind-whipped wildfires that can begin with just about any kind of spark.
We do not want to be one of those sources.
That's PG&E's Andrew Vesey urging residents to pay close attention to all the warnings.
If you have not yet signed up for automated advance notifications of the PSPS, please take this opportunity.